All right, well, ladies and gentlemen, it's time to get down to brass tacks. Time to get down to the facts. Just the facts, ma'am. Speaking of ma'am, Alan, how are you, my friend? Make sure you don't show the label.
Yeah, no. I'm well. I'm doing very well. Times two. So, I'm ready. Like Dr. Johnny Fever, I'm ready to tackle the subject at hand.
Johnny Fever?
Yeah.
What is that? What?
You don't know who Johnny Fever is. I forgot.
I don't know who Johnny Fever is.
You're still a youngster. Before your time, WKRP in Cincinnati. One of the greatest TV shows in the history of television.
WKRP in Cincinnati.
WKRP in Cincinnati.
This.
Look it up.
I know this.
You know, okay, you know the one about the turkeys that were dropped from the helicopter on Thanksgiving Day? You don't remember that,
yes.
Les Nessman?
That what?
Les Nessman, when he was at that mall in Cincinnati, where on Thanksgiving they had a promotion and they dropped all those turkeys. You haven't even seen WKRP, have you?
I'm going to go with a negative. No.
All right.
And so that's the name of the show, WKRP?
WKRP in Cincinnati.
Oh, well, no wonder. I was like, I've heard that before. But
yeah.
Seeing that I didn't know that that was the name of the show, I really have no idea what you're talking about. All right. Well, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Sons of History podcast. If you haven't yet, do us a huge favor. Subscribe wherever you're listening. And if you can, leave us a rating and review. And on this video, if you're watching on YouTube or if you're watching on the Epoch Times, they're on Epoch TV, leave us a comment, preferably a comment that makes sense. Run into some that just really go off the rails. I think I sent you one the other day, didn't I? I actually shared that around with a number of friends. I was like, this one started off okay and went off the rails real quick. So, comments sometimes are just perplexing. Anyways, if you're listening on Apple or wherever, you can, or on Spotify, you can leave us a rating and review. That would be very helpful to us. We're going to be talking about, speaking of getting to the truth, getting to the facts of the matter, we're going to be talking about sort of what it takes to get to the truth as best as possible on any particular subject. And Alan and I work very hard to try to figure out, the truth on various issues. I mean, we do various topics on this show, but even away from the show, we study and we research and we try to, figure out really both sides of the argument and trying to figure out which side, is the truth. Is it a combination of both? Is it a little bit of both? So I think this is going to be a good conversation. You ready, dude?
Yeah, I'm ready. And I think this would be a great conversation for people who, you know, let's say they are in social media and there are discussions about, you know, historical subjects. And we have a few listed. If you're going to dive in, you're going to be surrounded by, you know, crocodiles, as they say, or alligators, whatever the, what is that, whatever that saying is. So make sure that if you jump in, you better have your information correct. You better know your sources and be ready to defend yourself.
And I will say this, because we recommend that people do this, but you have to understand that whether you do that or not, and we highly recommend that you do, a majority of the people that are going to be on social media, popping off with comments or, and even on history sites. You and I are in a number of history groups on like Facebook, and the avalanche of bad history is ongoing. It's nonstop. And a lot of times people will take one particular claim about a person or an event or a nation or whatever, and they will go with that. And they will just drop that in there. Like, you'll have a great exposition, and somebody will inevitably throw in, oh yeah, well, what about, and it will be zing. And then they jump out, you know, they parachute out and leave you with this, well, now I've got to look into that if it's something that you haven't heard of, which is why you're saying, And I completely agree. Go in prepared, and go in prepared for all the stupid comments that are inevitably going to come your way.
Yeah, because the regurgitation of false information is going to happen quite a bit, and you will see it.
And we'll jump into these the topics, but I had a guy that just about every time I would post something historically related, he would pipe in, typically like a race-baiting comment. And it would be a comment that I hadn't heard of, and I would have to go and look into it, right? Every single time, there may have been one of the dozen plus times that he was correct. Every other time, he was absolutely wrong. And it was strictly from an agenda-driven comment. So,
yeah, I mean, I'm facing the same thing where I see it's usually the same topic over and over again, and we have them listed. But you know, just this past week alone, I think there were two or three examples where somebody made claims, and then you would see people piping in, and they're, you know, echoing the person who made the post. And I had to just go in there and I had to say, wait a minute, hold on a second. Okay. And then I would throw facts at them that they couldn't refute. They tried, but they did not succeed. So this is an example. And, you know, you and I, we discussed a famous historian. I don't want to mention his name. He's a friend of ours. But there's a historian that we know who, he stated himself that there's going to be folks on his side of the political spectrum who are going to try to control the narrative. And I was actually kind of surprised that he said that, but I think he saw it as a counter for what he sees as a narrative on the other side. So, you know, it's not good to have that kind of narrative to begin with. You really do need to have the truth. You know, we can go in having some of the discussions that we have, thinking that our side is the truth and not knowing the other side. So this is why it is important to hear from all sides. Yeah. But if you're going to argue about something, make sure that you've read all sides and make sure that the information that you're getting is factual and not someone like a Howard Zinn, which we will bring up. So,
yeah. And speaking of Howard Zinn, first and foremost, let's discuss like the Christopher Columbus stuff. We're going to go through sort of Western civilization topics and the effects of defending these individuals or these moments in history. Christopher Columbus.
Yeah. Well, I know in the 19, you know, I grew up in the 1970s and, you know, Christopher Columbus was beyond reproach. And, you know, same with the 80s. But then I noticed in the 90s when the 500th anniversary of Columbus's voyage to the discovery of the Americas, there was going to be a parade, a big event in San Francisco. I was living with my brother in San Francisco that year, and they canceled the festivities. And I didn't understand why, because there's a big Italian population in that city. And then I started hearing about genocide and slavery and all these different subjects, and they were all pointing directly at him, how he was a bad man. And I didn't know where all this came from. I mean, there's even a Knights of Columbus, which is a big Catholic organization. Well, you know, I finally got my answer. I'm going to give credit to Mary Graybar. I read this book, Debunking Howard Zinn, and she pinpoints exactly where Howard Zinn got his information and what he did to help the narrative that Christopher Columbus was this evil slave master that committed genocide. I looked at the primary sources, and I'm gonna give you an example. You know, there are a couple of books There are a couple of books out there. Columbus sailed on 4 voyages, and he did leave some memoirs. Now, not all of them have been saved, but, you know, there's a couple of books like Columbus on Himself. I don't know if you can see that. This is a Folio Society book. And then this author seems to be like the expert on Columbus, Samuel Eliot Morison. Now he has, this is one of his books, now he has the actual journals. And there's also, I don't know if it's the Penguin Classics also has his actual journals. And if you look at his journals, and then you look at what Howard Zinn wrote, Columbus would write journals that, you know, several days, several weeks. Well, what Howard Zinn did was he condensed them into a paragraph and separated sentences with ellipses, the 3 dots. So when you read the paragraph that Howard Zinn presented, you're getting a lie. You're getting a deliberate attempt to lie to his readers. And so this is an example of why you have to be careful with authors nowadays. The best thing, and we're going to hammer this, the best thing is go for primary sources. And we'll get into where you can get primary sources. But Christopher Columbus is a perfect example of getting primary sources. And fortunately for me, you know, I got to read Dr. Graybar, and I would not have even known what it was that Zinn did that was so, the deception that he committed until I read her book.
You know, speaking of Zinn, because it's in his famous and incredibly high-selling, like 2 million-plus copies book, The People's History of the United States, which whenever you see the people's whatever, you should quickly identify that as very left-leaning, very socialist, quasi-communist, if not full-fledged communist literature or rhetoric or however you want to put it. But whenever you see the people's whatever, just let that be a red light that goes off. But looking at his, speaking of going to the primary sources, Zinn did The People's History of the United States dating all the way back to the beginning of Columbus sailing to the New World. This is 1492, right? Well, speaking of primary sources, if you go and look into his bibliography, his cited sources, 90 to 95% are all from the 20th century. Now, he's covering 500 years of history. And Zinn was a legitimate historian. But this was obviously a complete agenda, political agenda, social agenda. And so 90 to 95% of his sources are from the 1900s. And it's like, dude, you published this, I think, in the 60s. And all of your information is typically coming from news articles and publications from the 1900s. And so it's like that right there is letting you know you're not doing your due diligence, and part of the due diligence is contemporary sources, your primary sources, who is around, such as the diaries. And one of the things Samuel T. Morison does is, I remember when I showed you my book that I had of what you just showed, and you're like, hey, isn't that mine? And I was like, no, I went and got one too. Thank you very much. But there's also Admiral of the Sea, which, you know, Morison goes through and addresses a lot of the claims that are hundreds of years old about what Columbus was doing, and just sort of correcting a lot of errors on things that have been accepted about the voyages and Columbus himself. So yeah, it's very important. Check the sources, not just the source, not just like who are you reading. Like check the sources of whatever it is that they've put together. One of the things that I did, because growing up we always heard that Columbus, during that time, they all thought that the world was flat. And obviously that is highly incorrect. It's in error, right? And that's one of the things that Morrison addresses in his book, his biography on Columbus, is talking about how it was Washington Irving, great guy, great writer, who wrote a biography on Columbus, who mentioned that Columbus was having this debate with a lot of scientists of the day on the earth being flat. And in fact, that conversation, that debate actually never happened. And Morrison addresses that in his book. And he also goes on to inform the reader that, hey, the idea that the world was a circle, was a sphere, was established in like ancient Greece, like ancient Greek times, about Aristosthenes, I think. Yeah, Aristosthenes. His whole Alexandria to Cyrene.
Have you heard of Sacrobosco?
No.
Sacrobosco, and he wrote a book called The Sphere of Sacrobosco. Now, that book came out, I think it came out in the 13th century, the 1200s. And it was one of the most bestsellers in the Middle Ages. And that book stated that the world was round. And that's hence the name, The Sphere of Sacrobosco. Look it up. It's one of the most important books in Western civilization, world history, in fact. And he goes into detail about the planet being round.
And I mean, that right there is like, it just lets you know, like, these people back in those days, they weren't just a bunch of bumbling morons. Like, they were very, very smart people. And this is 2,300 years ago, 1,800 years ago, when, you know, Columbus was about to do his voyage, that they already knew that the world was round, but they just didn't know how big the world was. That was the real issue, which explains like why Columbus thought he was like, hey, if I just go across the West Ocean, then I'll be able to cut through and quickly get to China and the West Indies, right? Well,
he grossly underestimated the size of Earth.
Correct.
And that's why a lot of the skeptics were like, dude, you're going to run out of water and food before you get there. Because they correctly assumed how big the planet was. But Columbus was like, no, it's smaller. I think based on the calculations, he came up with some calculations. I think he said he thought about maybe 20,000, that the perimeter or circumference was about 20,000 miles. But he's off by about 4,000 to 5,000.
So one of the other things is, how, and we talked about Oppenheimer last week, how movies and books and even songs can, you know, sway the way that we think about things. There was a song by Bing Crosby, Who's Laughing Now, something like that. But he mentions, you know, Columbus, they all laughed at him when he said that the world was round. And that was another thing that sort of just perpetuated this idea that the world was that the world, according to a lot of people, was flat. And so these are the things that we can't go by what movies tell us, what songs tell us, what fiction books tell us. We have to go, and sometimes, honestly, dude, we almost can't even go by what historians tell us and journalists tell us and writers tell us. We have to pull from numerous sources. You have to, just because somebody says something, and maybe it's the whole coming from authority, and that's not always something that you want to go off of. You want to be able to say, okay, this person who is in authority said this. What is this other person saying? What are the other people who have been looking into this, what are they saying, and does it match up, or is it completely off? What is it? It's sort of the whole biblical, like, out of two witnesses. Like, you can't bring a case forward unless you have at least two witnesses, right? It's sort of that. It's like, hey, you need multiple sources.
Well, not only that, but you need multiple, like we've been saying, you need multiple sources from even the opposition, the enemy. You know, I've had numerous debates with, there's a friend of mine, and I mentioned it last week. There's a friend of mine from high school who's a communist. And I'm not saying it as a derogatory term. The man is a communist. He embraces Marx. But, you know, when you have a discussion with him, he has legitimate concerns. Some of his arguments does have merit. What I have a problem with is his solution. I don't think socialism, and I think the world has shown that socialism, for example, does not work as a good economic system. But if you look at, say, the behavior of many of the CEOs and some of the chairmen of many of the corporations today, you know, you can kind of see why people are embracing socialism to some extent. So, you know, you do need to at least listen to what the other side has to say. You know, don't shut them down, don't cancel them. Listen to what they have to say. But that doesn't necessarily mean you need to embrace their solutions to the problem, because they might be going too far. You know, one of the Nazis, for instance, their solution to the Bolsheviks, that, you know, the Bolshevism and communism that was spreading through Europe, was to kill the Jews. Okay, yeah. I do think, yes, you do need to contain and then defeat communism, but killing an entire group of people is not the solution. So that, you know, that's what I'm talking about. There's a difference between, you know, listening to the other side and embracing what their solution is. So, you know, and it's not just, like I said, it's not just on Christopher Columbus. We have a list of so many other things where, yeah, listen to what the other side has to say and talk about it. For Christ's sake, talk about it so that we can, because, you know, we're not enemies of each other.
Yeah, it's one thing to... And that's where human nature comes in. Like, it's very easy to point out a problem, right? You take Bolshevism, right? That was a major problem, and it scared the crap out of a ton of countries because they were watching what was taking place in Russia. And so they were rightfully scared. But it's like, you can sit there and listen to somebody say, look, Bolshevism is a real problem. And you can be like, yeah, it is. And we got to do something about it. Like, yes, we do. Time to kill the Jews. I'm like, wait a minute, what? And that's where people, it's the whole like going off the rails type of thing. It's just like, yeah, you can point out a problem and it's a problem that everybody will agree to. But then all of a sudden you have people come up with these asinine solutions, and it's the whole, we've got to do something about capitalism and corporate greed, right? And it's like, yeah, we do. We do need to rein in the hardcore capitalists who are just like, you know, win by, you know, any means necessary, even if that means destroying literally your opponents, right? Your competitors. And it's like, yeah, we need to do something. It would be great to do something about corporate greed. Well, we need communism. Wait a minute. What do you mean communism? We need to have the government, which is run by people too, by the way.
Just as greedy and just as corrupt.
Yeah. And so we've got, well, I don't think that's going to work because you are taking from human nature and moving it in to another group that is also run by human nature with all the same desires, that it's just, it's a lateral move. Like, I don't understand, but now they have like all of the power. There's no combating anything. So we've seen what happens to countries when that happens, and it's not good. The best of it is you lose your individual freedom. The worst of it is tens of millions of people are killed either through executions or in disease or famine or just long-term imprisonment. So this is the thing. It's like, yeah, you can point out a problem, But what is your solution? And sometimes there is no solution. It's just like, look, our founding fathers figured it out. And I think it was well put by Madison when he said, look, if men were angels, governments wouldn't be necessary. And if governments were run by angels, then, you know, everything would work out. That's paraphrasing. But the fact of the matter is, they wanted to put in courts and establish the law and say, look, you have the individual freedom to do certain things, but when you start doing something wrong, when you do wrong things, you have to be held accountable. And that is the best that we can do. The law is the best that we can do. And it's the whole, and it goes back 1776, right? July 4th, 1776, same year, our good friend Adam Smith put out The Wealth of Nations. And one of the things that it says about, if you want a good government, it's peace, easy taxes, and a tolerable administration of justice. And it's like, that is the most that you can hope for. That's a solution to a problem that we can all live with.
Now, there have been, you know, I want to move into some of the other subjects that we have seen that, you know, where you're going to be jumping in and you're going to be called all kinds of names. But colonialism, slavery, and the treatment of Native Americans. Now, you know, there was a recent work that came out that the New York Times is promoting called the 1619 Project. And, you know, if you listen to the folks who promote the 1619 Project, you are going to walk away with the impression that the United States and or Western Europe has had a monopoly on slavery, has had a monopoly on colonialism, and the end result of what happened in the Native Americans. You know, if you're going to be wanting to know a little bit more about history, one of the things that you have to look at is you have to kind of look at the overall big picture. Now, what am I talking about? Well, for instance, let's talk about colonialism. I cannot think of any time in history since the prehistoric times where a large, powerful nation did not conquer its neighbors to expand its own borders, to expand its own way of life. If you take a look at books on Mesopotamia or Egypt, you know, they were conquering, like, let's take Mesopotamia, where modern day Iraq is. You had the Assyrians, you had the Chaldeans, you had the Persians, the, you know, different. And I know I'm missing many, many different little groups that, that were in there. The Babylonians, they were throughout their history invading each other and expanding. You know, you had large empires, the Babylonians and the Assyrians. You had the Hittites coming out of modern-day Turkey. That's just the way life was. If you watched the movie 300, you would see the Persians showing up in what is today known as Greece. Okay, so what was that? Well, that was imperialism. That was colonialism. That was just the way it was. The Phoenicians created Carthage. Carthage expanded. Rome expanded. The Greek states expanded. You know, the Athenian Empire expanded its sphere of influence. And if you look at North America, you look at South America, the Inca empires, the Aztec empires, empires that existed long before the Europeans even showed up on, you know, in the Western Hemisphere. In Africa, there was a history site on Facebook where they showed a map of Africa after the Berlin Conventions in the 1880s. And people were piping in saying, Europe has much to answer for. And how dare they, you know, conquer these people and assume that they can just rule them. And and not only that one, but also the Atlantic slave trade, where they only pointed out the slaves going to the Western Hemisphere. What was left out was the fact that a lot of slaves were being traded within Africa. A lot of slaves were being transported through the Indian Ocean into the Middle East, into, you know, China and India have been known to have more slaves at some points, more slaves than ever existed in what in the Western Hemisphere. So if you don't take a look at the big picture, if you don't look at man's mistreatment of their fellow man since the beginning of time, if you don't take that into consideration and you look strictly at what Europe did at a certain point for only, really, if you look at the whole scheme of things, only for a small amount of time in comparison to the rest of the world, you're going to walk away thinking Western civilization, the Europeans, had a monopoly on slavery, had a monopoly on colonialism. If you don't know that the North Africans were enslaving Europeans and that there were more European slaves in North Africa than there were in the Western Hemisphere, if you don't know this information and it's not being taught to you, you're going to walk away thinking Western civilization has much to answer for. They need to pay reparations. They need to, you know, absolve themselves of their sins. You're not getting the true story, and you're going to indict people who had nothing to do with slavery, who had nothing to do with colonialism. It was their descendants. But then the people who were enslaved, the people who were under the rule of colonialism, they themselves were imprisoning their fellow neighbors. They themselves were also participating in slavery. You know, the Europeans couldn't travel into the interior of Africa. The slaves that they purchased from the coastal regions, were purchased from Africans who were enslaving their fellow Africans. And they had been enslaving their fellow Africans and conquering their fellow Africans for thousands of years before, again, the Europeans even showed up on their shores during the Age of Discovery. So when I presented that case to, you know, these history sites, and I presented the fact that you have to look at the whole thing, the whole story, the big picture of it, that slavery and colonialism, if you want to call colonialism an indictment, because colonialism did do some positive things, like end the practice of seti in India, where the widows, the wives of dead Indian men, when they threw the dead Indian men on the funeral pyres and lit it up, they also threw the wives in there who were still alive. Well, Britain ended that practice. Britain was most responsible for ending the slave trade. They used their own navy to stop ships from the slave. They were stopping ships that were holding slaves. They stopped the slave trade. Now, not on the internal part of Africa, but definitely on the high seas. And then when the Europeans went and took over the African nations, their African territories. Now, granted, yes, the Belgian Congo, that's a very bad example of positive colonialism. But they did manage to use that to end the slave trade. So back to, if you're going to use colonialism as an indictment on Europeans or slavery, which definitely is an indictment, you have to consider that those two practices are an indictment against humanity. They're an indictment against humans. Their mistreatment of each other since the beginning of time, long before the European nations were created after the fall of the Roman Empire. So take that for what it's worth. And, you know, and on the Native Americans, the subject came up that, of genocide. You know, I got into a debate with some people in regards to the fact that when the Pilgrims landed in Massachusetts, what is today Massachusetts, in 1620, they found the area deserted. Well, what had happened was, and there's no evidence to suggest that it was intentional. Nobody really knows what happened, but they think that some fishermen, European fishermen, someone had some kind of a disease that nobody knows. It was a disease that Europeans are accustomed to facing and that they have the immunity for. Well, there was a pandemic, and it wiped out 80 to 90% of the Native American populations in what is today New England. Okay, that's not genocide. It was not an intended practice. At least there's no evidence to suggest that it actually was genocide. It was an unfortunate, a very unfortunate incident. And then the subject came of smallpox being infected on blanket, or blankets infected with smallpox that were used to wipe out the Native Americans. Well, again, I don't know, Dustin, maybe you have, but I haven't seen any evidence that that practice actually existed or that that was actually practiced. Now, I do know that during Pontiac's rebellion, after the Seven Years' War, the French and Indian War ended, there was a thing called the Pontiac's Rebellion, where the Native Americans were attacking English settlements all over North America. And General Amherst, who was the victor of North America, he was a British general, suggested that when what is today Pittsburgh was being besieged, and if those people, those Englishmen were captured by the Native Americans, those people were going to be butchered. You know, sorry to say it, but they tortured. You know, look up the word gauntlet, where the word gauntlet came from, or at least where the Indian method of the gauntlet. The gauntlet was a way to torture captives, whether they were civilian or military. They tortured captives. They ate their captives, and not just people of European descent. The Native Americans were known for eating their fellow Native Americans. So, you know, look, take it for what it's worth. I'm not speaking ill of Native Americans, but you know, they were not angels. They were pretty brutal themselves. So,
yeah, and like the whole, like, I think it was a number of times. Well, one, you see what smallpox can do, and you understand how it works during those days. Like, if it gets on something, it can spread. And the idea of that, well, now you've got germ warfare, or the potential for germ warfare. So I don't think the Amherst moment is singular. I think I've read it a few times where that was suggested, and I believe it was used before. Over time, like, that's something that you would use. I mean, you can go back to the days of the Mongol Empire. I mean, they used that whenever the plague hit, and they started sending dead bodies over city walls. Like, this is a method of warfare that has to be taken in its proper context. Right, wrong, indifferent, however you want to view it. But you also have to take it in its context. And at the same time, there's one thing to, like, suggest, should we do, you know, germ warfare? And if people are like, no, that's pretty effed up, we're not going to do it, then okay. You know, like the Amherst situation. One of the things that irritates me is when people talk about the civilizations of Babylonia, Mesopotamia, the Persians, the Greeks. You know, you can go all the way up through the Middle Ages, medieval times. I love that restaurant. You can go all the way up to the American Revolution if you want to. I mean, go all the way up through into the 19th century. And people will constantly say, but those people were backwards. They didn't know what we know. And it's this, I can stand on this soapbox and preach through my self-righteousness and condemn things that have already been defeated. Like, there are people who condemn slavery of pre-Civil War era, right? And like, and this needs to be corrected. And yet, they will do nothing about modern slavery, where you've got more slaves and like the sex slave trafficking going on in this world far outnumbers, maybe not in a per capita basis, but as far as accumulation, as far as total, far outweighs the number of slaves that existed in America, like at any point in time. They will not do anything about that. They will not speak against it, but they will speak condemningly of what was done in the past. And despite the fact that a war was fought, 750,000 people, soldiers killed, not just, these are not casualties, the updated number, I know we, for a long period of time, there was like 500 to 600,000, like the updated numbers, I think, came out about 10, 15 years ago. 750,000 guys killed, slaughtered each other in the Civil War, ultimately ending slavery in America. That bloodshed was not enough. Now, we've got to continue to condemn because, honestly, we got nothing else to do. We have, for my money, it's people who have zero purpose in their life except to try to make history feel bad about itself. It's like, look, there's plenty of stuff out there that we can talk about and say shouldn't have happened, shouldn't have been done, but you're sort of barking up a tree that no longer really exists. And so, especially when you have situations that are happening today and yet you will stand by and not do anything. You got kids impoverished in various countries. You're not doing a handout. You're not, you know, helping those kids out, you know, but you will readily condemn people who are long dead and gone.
And blame their descendants.
Correct.
And take it out on their descendants. You owe me money. Your very presence in my safe space is making me feel, I'm getting nervous. I'm getting scared. Where's my safety pin?
Bro, it's like, you know, Angela Davis, she's the former communist.
Yeah, she's a communist. Ran with Gus Hall or...
Yeah,
I think Gus Hall ran for president and vice president.
I think she's still a professor over at UC Davis, I want to say.
Oh, by the way, yeah, real quick, I just want to mention this real quick to you, and you can go back to her. The guy that ran, I think his name was Brennan. He was one of Obama. He was like the head of national intelligence under Obama.
Okay, yeah.
He voted for Gus Hall and Angela Davis.
Not surprising.
Yeah, he voted for Gus Hall, Communist Party candidate for United States. And he was the head of national intelligence under Obama.
Isn't that Steve Brennan? Isn't that his name? Steve Brennan?
I just remember.
It doesn't matter.
It might be. He's a... Yeah.
But she was on that show with Henry Louis Gates, who does... trying to find sort of the Ancestry.com thing. I think it's sponsored by Ancestry.com. Come to find out, like, she's big into reparations and big into, you know, all black people more or less were oppressed by slaves. Were like, we need reparations type of thing. And then come to find out her ancestors were slaveholders. I thought that was the most poetically... What is it? Poetic justice or something? You know, it's definitely irony.
Kamala Harris, I think one of her descendants or one of her ancestors was owned a plantation.
Yeah. So the movie Napoleon is coming out in November, the Ridley Scott movie. Ridley Scott, I'm a big fan. Love his movies. Blade Runner, Gladiator, all that jazz. Great stuff. And I am very excited about this film because I'm a big Napoleon fan. However, he made a comment, which is sort of an echo of other historians who have made these comments, social commentators making these comments, journalists, obviously, academics, no doubt, making comparisons of some kind to Hitler, Adolf Hitler and Napoleon Bonaparte. It really is a ridiculous and foolish comparison. Hitler is on a scale of the 20th century dictators, tyrants, and just all-out wicked people. The Stalins, the Maos, the guy who ran the Khmer Rouge, Pol Pot. People like that. Like, that's the scale of an Adolf Hitler. A Napoleon is on the level with an Alexander the Great, a Julius Caesar, a Frederick the Great. Like, these, it's completely, yes, they are, you can call them tyrants, you can call them dictators, but they are in two completely different camps. And I really wish that people would stop doing this careless comparison of a guy who should be looked at as a very interesting, complex, flawed accomplished, an incredible historical figure in Napoleon. And it's really irritating that these Hitler comparisons continue to be trotted out there. Napoleon and just about everybody else, that if you disagree with them, you're a Hitler or you're a Nazi. It's just foolishness. It really is. And it shows your historical illiteracy.
So let's talk about solutions. Solutions for the readers and the writers. I'm going to give a few of them for you.
I did want to say, and this will go right into it. This is going to go right into what you're going to say. But it ties into my Napoleon thing. It was only in the beginning of this century, 21st century, that the it's called the Foundation or the Fondation Napoleonic. In Paris, they've released, I think, like 33,000 letters from Napoleon, to and from Napoleon, which, according to our good friend Andrew Roberts, who's written an incredible, If you've never read anything on Napoleon, I would get this one. It came out about 10, 15 years ago. He's saying that people who wrote before these letters came out, before they were found and released, and this is 20 years ago, less than 20 years ago, they were working with, quote unquote, 2/3 of the puzzle. That's crazy. So you had all of these biographies, contemporary biographies as well, memoirs written, even memoirs that were done, dictated by Napoleon himself, not completely forthright. And that's another thing that, as far as primary sources that we're going to get into now, the letters are the primary sources. Napoleon would be a primary source, but at the same time, you have to look at the primary source and say, was there an agenda behind the writing of this primary source? Letters, typically not. Letters to and from people about specific things, usually there's not an agenda, a hidden agenda. Usually there's an agenda that you can plainly see, whether it's a military correspondence or it's a love letter, you know what the agenda is. But there are sometimes, like a memoir or an autobiography, where you don't know if there is an agenda until you start comparing them to other things. Go ahead.
Okay. So what I was going to mention is, solutions for the readers and the writers. Because there is a movement based on a lot of the things that we have been discussing. There is cultural Marxism and history revisionism is a real thing. I want to bring this up real quick before I talk about the solutions. If you look at CBS News, there's a whole string of people who went from either they were on the left to people who were extreme left. William Shirer and Edward R. Murrow. Socialist or communist sympathizers. Yes, believe it. You look it up yourself. You'll find that information. Walter Cronkite himself sitting there saying that the Vietnam War is now over after the American and South Vietnam victory of the Tet Offensive, which completely annihilated the NVA and Viet Cong presence in South Vietnam. It was a military victory, but a political defeat. You also have, I don't know if I just mentioned it, the Frankfurt School. Look up the Frankfurt School and their influence on American education. We mentioned Howard Zinn. There's a new book called Anne Frank's Diary, The Graphic Adaptation. A lot of reporters are trying to make it look like, there's a censorship going on regarding this particular book. Well, there is a legitimate diary on Anne Frank. And that's not what this is. This is a graphic adaptation. Criticism of it is that it's not entirely accurate and it gets into some sexual content, and which is the reason why it's being banned in schools. The regular diary is not being banned, but this graphic adaptation is. There has been, if you looked at like the defense of Alger Hiss and the Rosenbergs, who were communists, communist spies, there was something called the Venona Papers, which has not been publicized, which confirmed, hey, these guys really were communists. And there's a whole slew of information that people have not heard about, the Katyn massacre, the fate of the Kulaks in the Soviet Union.
But speaking of the Venona Project, you know, that wasn't completely released until the 90s.
Yeah.
And that's one of the things that we also have to keep in mind when we are trying to do research. And I say we as in like everybody who's listening and you and I. We have to keep in mind that sometimes the information is not released yet. Like the Napoleon letters. 33,000 of them. The Venona Project. Intelligence hadn't been released. You and I talked to Barrett Tillman, I think a year ago, talking about Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Intelligence reports didn't come out identifying specifically what was going on until 30 years later, until 30 years after the bombs were dropped. And you had books that were written that suggested, like Gar Alperovitz's work, Atomic Diplomacy, which came out in 1965. He was saying that we dropped the bomb not so that we could have Japan surrender, but so that we could intimidate the Soviet Union. It's a theory, but it's a theory that was more or less debunked, and I hate that word, but it was debunked. And one of the guys who understood Russia and the USSR more than anybody, and he was arguably our greatest diplomat of the 20th century, George Kennan, hated that work because he thought it was so, one, reckless, and two, incorrect, just ahistorical. And so George Kennan went after that book. Another one that came out, this is well after the intelligence information came out. This is 20 plus. This came out in 2000. Edwin Hoyt's work, Inferno.
I read that book. That book, I mean, it good stories, but it was really...
But it was talking about...
It pissed me off. That book pissed me off.
That the bombs were not necessary. And yet the information, the intelligence had already been provided stating, here are the potential numbers of casualties and deaths. More and really saying, yes, the usage of the bomb saved God knows how many lives, and the bombs were necessary. And you can take that information, ignore it, and write a book like Inferno, and people will gravitate to it. People still gravitate to the whole atomic diplomacy. They still gravitate to the idea that was behind Inferno. And that's one of the issues. And with the Venona Project, people still try to defend the Rosenbergs. And it's like, you have all of this information free to the public showing, I think it was the Army's SIS operation that, hey, the Rosenbergs were balls deep into the Soviet spy ring.
And same,
there's
same
no
with,
doubt
same
about
with
it.
Alger Hiss. Alger yes. Hiss, they still defend Alger Hiss.
And that's what I'm saying. It's like, sometimes you can get so caught up in a political movement, an ideology, an agenda that you completely ignore. And I think that's like going back to Christopher Columbus when people say, you know, they thought that the earth was flat. Or people who still say, yeah, that the earth is flat. It's like you are ignoring centuries and centuries of math and research and exploration by countless people from various countries showing you and proving to you. And it's one of those things, like, even if you got in a spaceship and took off and saw the world as it was, you still would not be convinced, I don't think. And that's the world that we live in, but don't be like that.
But this is why if when we're talking about cultural Marxism and how they've taken over education, you know, and it's what I just mentioned. You rarely are going to find anything about what happened to the people in the Ukraine under Stalin. What happened to the kulaks? Look at the kulaks. These were landowners who did not, then they were peasants who did not want to see their farms become confiscated by the government. The Katyn massacre, where 22,000 Poles were massacred just because they were not communists. The lack of movies. There's a lot of movies against the Nazis, which is great. I enjoy almost all of them. But, you know, how many movies? I can name a few. The Killing Fields, Night Crossing, which really wasn't that well known. Red Dawn, Manchurian Candidate, and the fourth Indiana Jones movie, which were against the Soviets or the communists. But minimum amount versus what you see about other groups. Now, Roger Scruton.
Yeah.
Okay, now he wrote a book called Thinkers of the New Left, and this one's called Fools, Frauds, and Firebrands, Thinkers of the New Left, who exposes the Frankfurt School. When his book came out, there was a concerted effort to have him canceled. They were contacting the publisher saying, get rid of his book. If you continue to, they told the publisher, if you continue to publish any more of his books, then we're going to cut you guys off. Universities were against him being, tenured. They wouldn't. There's been a lot of professors. We don't have time to go through the whole list of professors that have been canceled in places like Missouri, Chicago, Portland State, Tulane, where, you know, you speak up against something that could be the truth, and they were being hounded by mobs. Look at some of the people who have spoken out about certain subjects, whether it's Gina Carano, Russell Brand, Tim Ballard, who is exposing the modern day slavery, J.K. Rowling, many, many others, where they're being either arrested, like Andrew Tate. You may not agree with Andrew Tate, but there's no doubt that they went after him because of the things that he was saying. James Sweet, who is president of the American Historical Association, Jordan Peterson, newscasters. I can go on and on about what happens to people who don't go along and get along with,
it's this, that's the whole thing is like, and people will say, whoa, 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 whoa. Russell Brand, didn't you hear what took place? And it's like, here's the thing. And whenever an accusation comes out, for my money, it's never good to take either side. But our country was based on you're innocent until you're proven guilty. You don't have to go in and prove your innocence. They have to prove your guilt beyond the shadow of a doubt.
Yeah, look at Brent Kavanaugh.
That's the whole, yes. And what I'm leading to is I've seen this song and dance before, and Brett Kavanaugh is one of the primary moments. Herman Cain was another one. Like he started, he wanted to run for president. All of a sudden, sexual allegations. Like these things.
Yeah. Clarence Thomas.
Like we've seen this song and dance before. And it's very interesting that it would happen to be all pretty much always a conservative side that's being accused of these things. It's very interesting. Russell Brand was nuts. Back in, before he, I guess, did some type of complete life change. And all of a sudden you're like, man, this guy is actually pretty smart and makes sense. You know, the wild lifestyle that he lived before, who knows? And that's what I'm saying. Like, I don't take either side, but I also know that you're innocent until you're proven guilty. People get accused of stuff all the time. Doesn't mean that every one of those people are guilty. And the thing is, like, you can go back. There's a line in the guy who wrote The Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, Edward Gibbon. He makes a point about how Rome fell into that, where the accused were guilty. And it's like, dude, that is a scary place to be, and that's where we are.
The Salem witch trials, that's an example.
Yeah, that's another one. It's like, we accuse you of being a witch. I'm like, burn her, you know, or like throw her off a ledge. And if she lives, she was a witch. If she dies, she wasn't a witch, you know, or something along those lines. Or maybe it was reversed, but it was just so freaking wild. And it was, I want to say it was ancient Greece that they used to have it to where if a percentage of the jury was not convinced of the person's guilt, then the person who was accusing had to suffer the potential penalty of what they were accusing that person of. Now, me personally, I think that's a wild thing, but I also, like, I am not against that. I think that maybe there should be some type of deterrent for just these random accusations. We live in a country of complete litigation. Like, we can, it is true, you can sue anybody for anything. You can accuse anybody for anything, even if it's not true, and you won't be held to the fire, more or less. And that's a problem. That is what you would call a political weapon. And we see that it is a political weapon constantly used in this country and in the West. And it has reared its ugly head once again. And it's just a way to keep people silent. And it's just a way to destroy somebody's life.
All right, let's get into the examples of primary sources in places where
you've got like 2 minutes. We're already done.
I'm gonna do it quick.
Go.
You talk too long. That's your problem right there. That's why we're behind.
I have something to say. You're like going on, and you know, I don't even know what you're talking about.
All right, whatever. Okay, primary sources. Okay, so if you want to get into a discussion of the Constitution, there are primary sources like Patrick Henry. Samuel Adams, okay, great source. The Federalists, you want to know what the Constitution really was about? James Madison, John Jay, Alexander Hamilton. George Mason. George Mason has his own memoirs. So if you want to read, there you go.
What's the agenda?
Great source of information. Okay, Library of America has a whole slew of books that are... You can read now these are just some examples. You have like, I just grabbed a bunch of books, but like John Adams, Benjamin Franklin. What do I have in there? I have the debates on the
I don't know. It's all blurred. Thomas Jefferson on there.
Yeah,
I
Jefferson.
Mean, don't forget Madison's notes.
Yeah,
don't
debates
forget
on
Madison's
debates.
Notes.
Oh, I got that, dude. I have it right here. Okay, you can find this. It's called Records of the Debates in the Federal Convention of 1787. Okay, that right there. And it's not just that. The Founders' Constitution, which is going to lead me into the next one called the Liberty Fund. If you go to these websites, now I'm going to give you a second to get your pen or whatever. Liberty Fund. The Law Book Exchange Limited, Library of America, Samuel Johnson's Dictionary. Now, if you want to take a look at his dictionary, you can go online or you can get hard copies, but the hard copies are kind of expensive and they're pretty big books. But get the one between 1773 and 1786 because those are the revised editions. If you want to know... like for instance, if you get into a debate on, the Second Amendment, and I've seen John Stewart mention words such as regulated. Well, regulated, according to John Stewart, is the incorrect definition. If you want to know the correct definition that the Founding Fathers were referring to about a well-regulated militia, you got to read Samuel Johnson's dictionaries. Get any edition between 1773 and 1786, because the convention was in 1787. And he died, I think, in 1784 or 85, one of those years.
Samuel Johnson, isn't that was that Mark Twain?
Who? Mark Twain, he died in 1910.
I know, I'm just kidding.
Halley's
Samuel Johnson.
Comet. Idiot. Halley's
Samuel
Comet.
Samuel Clement.
The Liberty
Whatever.
Fund. Liberty Fund and the law book, the one I just mentioned, the Law Book Exchange, you can read commentaries by Beccaria. Sir, now this is pronounced Cook, Sir Edward Cook. Lots of others, like the guy named Upshur, who wrote about what the federal government was really all about in the Constitution. Get the actual sources, the documents, get the actual, and get it in hardcover. Yeah, I'm sorry, get it in print, because what they put online is not necessarily going to be the truth. I got into a debate with someone about what happened during the Cuban Missile Crisis. He said, well, not him, but her, but mutual friends were saying, well, you were wrong about what happened. No, I wasn't. I had Robert Kennedy. He was right there. These are his memoirs. So I was like, I know what was going on. Sir Henry Clinton talks about what happened with Benedict Arnold. So these are just some examples of some, you know, and there's, believe me, there's a lot more. The American Historical Association has a bibliography of a lot of books that you can find. And I would welcome you to just don't listen to what the president says, because he's now groveling over his criticism of the 1619 Project. But the Federalist Papers, just, you got to read what Madison has to say. It's quite impressive. So
yeah, I mean, it's hard to listen to today's politicians when they're running around in shorts and hoodies.
Yeah. So I want to credit people like Mary Graybar, Joe.
No,
hold on. We're going to do this.
We're not going to do it. We're not going to do it.
Donald Crenshaw, Mark Boonstra, they have provided information for you that you can go and look at some of the information. You know, like Joe Wolverton has mentioned, there's a lot of writers that we are not being taught about.
Correct.
Any of their information. And if you want to know what they're thinking, you have to read their books. There you go. Got it in there. And your archaeology and understanding agendas.
That's what she said. Anyways.
Hey, you know, we got to provide our listeners with, about stuff.
I completely agree. And you know what? I'm going to make this a clip for people to listen to. Because I think all that information was great. And I like the way that you presented it in such a hurry, with such fervor, with such passion. It was a beautiful moment in time.
Well, yeah, people can go back and rewind and listen. So, you know, on our YouTube, be sure to subscribe to us on YouTube.
It's called the pause button.
Yeah, the pause button.
They can do it. They can write it down. They can use the pause button. All right, man. Well, it was good to talk to you. I think we knocked out a whole bunch here. We ended up, you know what? I said we weren't going to be able to knock out those other two sections. And you said, F you, we're going to do them anyways.
You know, we needed to. It's part of the discussion, because people need to understand that, you know, our gripes are legitimate. There is a movement going on to history revisionism. And when a majority of students and the young, the Generation Z, embrace socialism and their self-loathing white people who hate their European ancestors, you know, there's something behind all that, especially when you consider all the, you know, you want to talk about the worst massacres, you got to look at the Mongol invasion. Yet I don't see Genghis Khan statues being, or restaurants named after him being destroyed.
Yeah, exactly. To an extent, the fight for history is a fight for the future.
Yeah. And don't, you know, I mean, people are going to judge us 100 years from now because we ate meat or we had pets. Oh, you owned an animal as a form of slavery? I have a feeling. I have a feeling. People 100 years from now are going to be judging us based on the fact that we eat meat or we had pets.
Absolutely. If we continue on this trajectory, there will absolutely be that. And you know, you didn't allow abortion up to 5 years after birth. What is wrong with y'all?
or the death penalty, the fact that we have the death penalty or that we have prisons.
There it is. Like, yeah, the death penalty for people who have gone and butchered and raped God knows how many people, you know, tortured people. But a child that is innocent, a baby that is innocent, you didn't allow the mother to kill that baby. What's wrong with you? So it's like, okay, that's the wicked world that we live in, where it's bizarro world, up is down, left is right, dogs are sleeping with cats. All right, dude, I'm done. It's been a wonderful conversation with you, as always. I love our talks.
As do I. It's good to have our little debates and listening to you talk, man. It's such a wonderful experience.
Yeah. Pleasurable, I'm sure.
Better than watching Seinfeld or Friends, who they need to be canceled for the subject no matter doubt. that they brought up.
Yeah, how dare they? Those anti-dentites. All right, man. I'll see you later, brother. Have a good one.
All right, you too, bud. Take care. See you next week.